I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The first day of President Trump's impeachment trial stretched into the wee hours of the morning as the House managers and the president's lawyers fought over rules and evidence. After some 13 hours, the partisan divisions held with votes about procedure falling along party lines. The president is charged with abuse of power and obstruction of Congress for attempting to pressure Ukraine to dig up dirt on Vice President Joe Biden, a political rival, and for blocking testimony and documents to the House for their impeachment inquiry. Yesterday, the Democrats demanded documents and witnesses, saying it would not be a fair trial without them, while Trump's lawyers argued the president's actions were not impeachable because he did not break the law. Both sides now have 3 days to make their case before members of the Senate who are not allowed to speak or use their cell phones. WHYY is carrying NPR's coverage of the impeachment trial, which will begin at 1 o'clock this afternoon. Well, today on Radio Times, what happened yesterday, why it matters, and what to expect in the days ahead. Joining us is Siobhan Hughes. She's Capitol Hill reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Hopefully we can get her hooked up. Howard Fineman joining us as well. He is NBC, MSNBC news analyst. Wrote a book a year or so ago called The 13 American Arguments. And Howard Fineman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We hear them, but apparently they are not hearing us. But we do have a third guest, Claire Finkelstein, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio. She's a professor of law, professor of philosophy, and director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also a senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. Claire, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. I do want to get to so many different things that happened, but what was your overall takeaway? And you were telling me before going on the air that you were pretty much watching to the bitter end. What was your takeaway from what we observed yesterday?
Well, it was very interesting because the Democrats put forward a number of amendments to the Republican proposed rules. And most of those had to do with trying to get witnesses in or trying to get documents in. Now, a number of Republican senators had said in advance that they were prepared to vote for witnesses, yet they were not willing to vote for the amendments to these rules.
Right.
That's a really interesting fact in and of itself. I don't think the Democrats were surprised by that. I think they expected those amendments to go down in flames. But yet, why is it that those Republican senators who had said, hey, I think we should hear some witnesses, were not prepared to vote for those amendments?
They did get a little thing, which was to add another, day to some of this testimony. Senator Mitchell wanted to basically cram it all into 24 hours. They got another, I think, 12 hours. A small victory?
It is a small victory. It is an indication that some members of his own party were inclined to be a little bit more lenient, that they were inclined to extend the discussion a little bit. And, of course, it was just an unrealistic schedule to begin with to suggest that there would be two 12-hour days. And, of course, that doesn't include breaks.
Right.
So that it now extends over a third day is appropriate, I think.
It did go until early morning this morning.
It did indeed.
A very long day. This is something I do want to talk with our other guests about, but it was pretty obvious, and I don't think this is a partisan statement on my part, watching how the managers from the House, who were Democrats, how they made their arguments yesterday and how the Republican or the lawyers representing the White House made their arguments. And on the one hand, the Democrats had video. They had graphs. They basically went through all the impeachment inquiry findings and introduced that to the Senate.
It was very, very fine lawyering on their part. They were extremely well prepared. They knew exactly what was going to happen. And it was, in effect, calling the witnesses they couldn't call to show the videotape, to show the clips, and to make clear why these witnesses were so relevant, or the excerpts from the documents, why those documents were so relevant and so important. And it did not make the Republicans look good to be refusing to hear these witnesses and refusing to let in these documents when the Democrats had demonstrated their relevance so clearly.
In fact, the Republicans have been called out this morning or even last night saying that some of the things that the lawyers said representing the White House were actually false. One was that they claimed that a lawyer, the House Judiciary Committee, would not let a lawyer from the White House be present at the hearing. Incorrect. Also, that House Republicans were denied access to a closed-door deposition of witnesses. This was back in the fall. Not correct.
Well, of course, there are Republicans on the committee. So, of course, there were Republicans in those hearings, and they said it over and over and over again. But, it's curious because, of course, the Republicans on that committee represent their colleagues in being at that committee.
We're talking about the U.S. Senate. I don't know how many members of the Senate are lawyers, but I'm assuming it's probably a majority of them. And it's so interesting to think of lawyers, and these are obviously very accomplished lawyers, sitting in an impeachment trial, listening to the two sides make their arguments.
Well, yes. And again, it really boils down to the witnesses, because polls have shown that a majority of Americans want to hear witnesses, think witnesses are relevant. I think the White House lawyers were in a very difficult position, because trying to defend a client when they can't provide any evidence puts them in a spot. And these are some of them very good lawyers, but they have their marching orders. Mm. I think it's a mistaken strategy for them, but we understand how well coordinated it is with Mitch McConnell, and that this has been well orchestrated.
Well, in fact, he said that he and basically the White House were on the same page when it comes to this trial.
Correct. And he took an awful lot of heat for that. And some of the pushback from his more moderate colleagues may partly be based on embarrassment over the role he has confessed to playing in the coordination with the defendant.
And that's Claire Finkelstein, again, professor of law, professor of philosophy, director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania. Our guests, as we talk about yesterday's 13 hours of debate and arguments, the first day of the impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. Siobhan Hughes is Capitol Hill reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Fingers crossed that we have connected with her. Siobhan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We can hear her. She cannot hear us. So we will try that again. I'm just taking directions from my producers and my engineers as well. Let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can also send us an email, you can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. At least I hope you can, because it seems like we are having some problems with the phones. Well, let's talk about the argument coming from the lawyers representing the President of the United States, saying basically that this impeachment hearing is ridiculous, unconstitutional, because the president did not break the law. That is one of several arguments that they're making, basically trying to discredit what the Democrats are trying to do or did in the House and trying to do in the Senate. Let's talk about what is an impeachable event or incident.
Well, as I think every American by now should understand, the category of high crimes and misdemeanors is not a legal category, but a political category. So it is not necessary to have actually broken the law in order to have committed an impeachable offense. And that doesn't mean that the president did not break the law, right? Perhaps he did. But what's important here is there's no judicial forum for determining whether or not, in fact, he violated federal law. That is not on the table. So the way that impeachment works is that it is a political charge. Very often it is also a crime and would be an indictable offense if we were in a court of law. Hmm. But since there is a longstanding tradition that says that a sitting president cannot be indicted, we don't go in the criminal direction. we look at it as a political charge, and that's what the Senate is addressing now. It's a very bad argument for White House lawyers to be making at this point.
But and these are the impeachment charges brought over from the House. So,
right.
So the House did not say that the president broke the law. They're just saying he abused it, not just. They said he abused his power and obstructed Congress.
Right. Now, it's important to note that there are a number of offenses that, once again, were we in a court of law, could be charged here. It is against the law to solicit bribes from a foreign leader. It is against the law to exploit a foreign sovereign nation, right? And so there are crimes here. And of course, it is against the law to obstruct justice and obstruct Congress in an official proceeding. But once again, the only reason why we are not addressing the actual criminality of these offenses is that that's not the procedure that our tradition and our history sets out for addressing the misdeeds of a president.
A lot of people have been quoting Alexander Hamilton, Federalist 65, defining high crimes and misdemeanors as, though, and I'm quoting here, those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust. Is that helpful?
Yeah, it's very helpful. And remember what the two articles of impeachment are. So the first one says that the president abused his office. And one of the claims that the Republican lawyers made is that, well, haven't there been withholdings of aid by prior presidents, right? There were lots of examples of cases in which aid has been withheld to foreign nation, for example, Obama and Egypt.
And Egypt was going through its own small revolution there.
Right. And isn't this a standard thing that presidents do? But the charge of abuse of office comes from the fact that what the president is accused of doing is withholding that aid, not because it was seen as politically necessary or in the national security interests of the U.S., or done in conjunction with our allies as being a wise thing to do, but that the president withheld the aid in order to advantage himself and gain an advantage over a political rival, namely Joe Biden. That is what constitutes the abuse of office. And that's what the Democrats kept coming back on last night. And so the president's lawyers are sort of barking down these paths that have such easy answers to them that I think their defense did not come off as compelling as it might have.
We're almost up in a break here, and I should just add that the GAO recently reported that President Trump violated the law when he withheld military aid to Ukraine, just to sort of add to the sort of drip-drip of allegations and
charges.
That's
right, and that's a point that the Democrats brought home last night as well.
We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Again, Claire Finkelstein is our guest. We've got two other guests that we hope we can connect with after this very short break, talking about yesterday's impeachment trial in the Senate. It is underway. It will start again this afternoon. And again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking about what happened yesterday and into the early hours of this morning, the debate and arguments in the U.S. Senate about the impeachment trial of President Trump. And again, Claire Finkelstein with us for the full hour from the University of Pennsylvania. Siobhan Hughes is Capitol Hill reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She was there. Her cover story or her story is above the fold in The Wall Street Journal this morning. And Siobhan, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's so good to be here.
So what was it like, I guess, spending that marathon session with the senators, just the tone, the mood, the attitude in the Senate?
It was remarkable to watch 100 senators have to sit in their chairs for essentially more than 12 hours and focus on the subject at hand. For months now, anytime reporters have asked particularly Republican senators what they make about the latest allegations surrounding Donald Trump and Ukraine, they've said, I don't know, I haven't been paying attention. And so at a minimum, what the impeachment trial does is to take that excuse or that dodge off of the table. It was interesting to see each of the seven different managers and some of the approaches that they took. You saw Adam Schiff's ability to really synthesize an argument. You saw the White House relying on some rhetorical talking points mm-hmm. that, for people who paid close attention to the trial, may not have been so meaningful, but for somebody outside the Beltway who is more able to focus on a simple soundbite, may in fact have been quite powerful. One of the White House arguments that was made over and over again had been that the president had been falsely accused. And the point the White House lawyers made was, if it can happen to him, the president of the United States, it can happen to you too. Now, the question of whether or not that has any basis, it seemed to be an assertion without facts to back it up, could be a little bit meaningless if it is a message that is easy for the public to receive and digest.
Well, it seems there were two audiences, if not more, maybe even three, including President Trump, who is in Europe. But you've got the senators there, 100 of them, and then you've got whoever was watching or listening. And I'm assuming from what you're saying, Siobhan, is that coming from the Democrats and then coming from the White House lawyers, trying to appeal to those audiences in different kinds of ways.
Exactly. And a lot of this was a calculated appeal. So for the Democrats were carefully chosen by and large for their ability to appeal to the moderate middle. In particular, for practical purposes, the four Republicans who the Democrats are going to need if they are going to be able to bring in witnesses like John Bolton, like Mick Mulvaney. Democrats do pretty much acknowledge that it's unlikely they're going to get the Republican support to convict the president. So for them, this is an exercise in really bringing the facts out in a way that the moderate middle might understand and might cause that independent crew to side more with the Democrats.
Claire, this is a trial. I mean, it's an impeachment trial. So on the one hand, it's political. But on the other hand, it's a trial. One of the arguments coming from the Democrats was, we need witnesses, we need testimony, we need evidence, we need documents if we're going to act as a jury in a trial. Walk us through, I guess, sort of what makes this so unique?
One of the strangest things about these proceedings as a legal proceeding is that in effect, the jury makes up the rules as they go along. That's not something that you see in an ordinary criminal proceeding. So last night's debate, even though it was very substantive, was actually on what are the rules by which this trial is going to take place. The actual trial doesn't start until today. And so they are hammering out what are the rules of evidence. Will we be able to present evidence? Will we be able to present witnesses? That's a very strange way to conduct a proceeding. And it tilts you very much towards the potential role of the Chief Justice here, because he is the neutral figure who is supposed to be dispensing justice and holding this body to account, though it looked from all intents and purposes last night as though he is reduced to playing quite a ceremonial role.
Well, let me play a clip, and this is Chief Justice John Roberts, and he's actually admonishing the House managers and the President's counsel for their manner and language. This was very late at night, so I think people's nerves were probably frayed, but nonetheless, let's hear Chief Justice John Roberts.
Will there be a fair trial? I submit that this is an even more important question than how you vote on guilt or innocence, because whether we have a fair trial will determine whether you have a basis to render a fair and impartial verdict. It is foundational, the structure upon which every other decision you will make must rest. If you only get to see part of the evidence, if you only allow one side or the other a chance to present their full case, your verdict will be predetermined by the bias in the proceeding. If the defendant is not allowed to introduce evidence of his innocence, it's not a fair trial. So too for the prosecution. If the House cannot call witnesses or introduce documents and evidence, it's not a fair trial. It's not really a trial at all.
Obviously, that is not Chief Justice John Roberts. That is Representative Adam Schiff, impeachment manager for the Democrats. This is in a statement to the Senate impeachment trial, essentially asking for a fair trial. And Claire, if I can go back to you and Siobhan, I'll go back to you as well, because you were speaking to that, which is sort of what is this trial about?
Right. So normally, if you have a trial, you have to have evidence. The Republicans have been making the argument that, in effect, the record was already provided by the House proceedings, and the witnesses that were put on constituted the presentation of evidence and the calling of witnesses. There is something of a point to that argument, though I don't think it carries the day. But the point is that the Democrats did not subpoena witnesses that they could have subpoenaed. And Jerry Nadler made pretty clear when they completed those proceedings why. They spent 8 months trying to affirm the decision to call Don McGahn,
right,
the president's lawyer, and it took. They didn't want to wait another 8 months to affirm the decision on appeal that, in fact, he had to respond to the subpoena. So they felt that it was going to drag out the proceedings unnecessarily to chase down all of those witnesses. But it might be that that would have been their better course for calling these essential witnesses because, of course, they don't control the forum now, given that they don't have the votes to insist on the witnesses.
Because, obviously, it's now in the Senate. To you, Siobhan, I mean, it seems like there was some possibility of witness trading. You know, we'll take Mulvaney if you give us one of the Bidens. Is that a real possibility?
It seems unlikely to me at this point, but it's not impossible. And the reason it's not impossible is once we go through opening arguments and after the senators have had those 16 hours to ask questions and receive answers, there will be a vote, a general vote on whether the Senate wants to call for witnesses and more documents. And if four Republicans join all 47 Democrats to get the 51 votes needed to pass that, then you would see a series of individual votes on individual witnesses, individual documents. And in that scenario, you could envision a situation in which there is some horse trading. A group of senators agrees, yes, if you bring in Joe Biden, we will vote to bring in Mick Mulvaney or John Bolton. And so it's not impossible.
Is having testimony, though, Claire, risky? I mean, maybe riskier than documents, and documents are right there in black and white, but testimony can go in a bunch of different directions.
That's right. Well, this is a fascinating issue, this question of horse trading on these witnesses. One question is whether or not when in the House, when the Republicans were demanding the minority hearing day, there was any discussion of horse trading of witnesses there. I think that would have been the Democrats' best course because I don't think that calling Joe Biden or Hunter Biden would do them a lot of damage. But here now it seems to me most Democrats would likely be open to that kind of deal, and it's the Republicans who don't want it. Interestingly, three of the senators, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Amy Klobuchar, have every reason to want Biden to testify, which is they would probably love to throw him under the bus. The politics are very complicated here, but I think the Mitch McConnell's rules that there has to be a single up or down vote on witnesses actually increases the chances that there will be a deal if there's any kind of move to have witnesses among the Republicans at all.
Siobhan, can you speak to the fact that we've got, what, three people running for the Democratic nominee for president who are sitting quietly and listening to all this testimony?
Yeah, so this is not an ideal situation for these three Democrats. They would prefer to be out in Iowa. The caucuses there are right around the corner, and they are losing their chance to do the on-the-ground work that is so valuable in winning that caucus. But Claire is right. There's a sense in which this cuts both ways, and while Joe Biden may be perfectly able to defend himself on the Senate floor should he ever, in fact, testify. I do think that there ends up being a taint associated with these constant refrain over and over again of Joe Biden and his son, because even if there is no evidence that Joe Biden did anything wrong, and in fact, when he got the Ukrainian prosecutor general fired, that prosecutor general was widely viewed as corrupt, right, there does arise this question in people's minds about what was his son Hunter doing on the board of a Ukrainian energy company, and was there a conflict of interest, either real or implied?
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you, and I'm happy to say a very patient Howard Feynman is joining us as well. Siobhan Hughes is Capitol Hill reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Claire Finkelstein is director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania. And we have finally connected with Howard Feynman. He is NBC, MSNBC news analyst. And Howard, thank you for your patience, and thank you for joining us on Radio Times once again.
Can you hear me?
I can finally hear you, yes. Thanks.
What if a pundit talks in the wilderness and nobody hears?
I know. I heard noises, but I did not hear you, so we're happy to have you, and I'm sorry about it took you half an hour to get you on the air. But nonetheless, here you are, and I'm happy to have you. We've been talking about a lot of what's been happening or what has happened over the last 13 hours yesterday and into the early morning hours of today in the U.S. Senate. What is your major takeaway as you watched what was happening?
Well, I was in the gallery for a good bit of it yesterday and into the evening, and it reminded me less of an impeachment trial than a divorce proceeding. In the sense that the legal theories, if you can call them that, on the Republican side are so diametrically opposed as to not touch each other, really. I mean, Donald Trump and his representatives are essentially saying that the whole proceeding is invalid. They're sort of reluctantly participating, but their main argument is that there's no validity to the proceeding. And, of course, the Democrats are saying there's no validity to your rejection of it. Yes. This is what the Constitution requires. So it's a difficult thing. I thought Schiff and the Democrats handled themselves terrifically and were great lawyers, but essentially the Republicans and Donald Trump are saying, so what? We didn't do anything wrong. We're only here because we have to be here at a minimum. And that makes it difficult to interpret legally, but makes it all too clear politically. This is basically the start of the 2020 campaign is not beginning in Iowa, it's beginning on the floor of the Senate.
Well, that's interesting. We have played a clip from Adam Schiff. Let me play a clip from a Trump attorney, Jay Sekulow. This is in a statement to the Senate impeachment trial yesterday, questioning the argument made by chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler. Now, Nadler said that Trump's team was citing executive power, which he thought was a, quote, nonsense argument in this circumstance. Here's what Jay Sekulow said.
The chairman of the Judiciary Committee at this body, on the floor of this Senate, said executive privilege and other nonsense. Now think about that for a moment. Executive privilege and other nonsense. Mr. Nadler, it is not nonsense. These are privileges recognized by the Supreme Court of the United States. And to shred the Constitution on the floor of the Senate, to serve what purpose? The Senate is not on trial. The Constitution doesn't allow what just took place.
This is a complicated, we're jumping into a complicated part of the argument. But let me go back to you, Claire. Executive privilege isn't on the table, is it?
It's really puzzling what's going on with that exchange around executive privilege. Expectation is that if witnesses were called, the president would try to block them by asserting executive privilege. He has indicated that he would do that. And there's been a lot of assertion of executive power. For example, the president has in the past said that Article 2 allows him to do whatever he wants. So when he engages in activity that seems to obstruct Congress, for example, one suspects that he has an idea of executive privilege and executive power standing behind it. Now, the debate was about whether or not the president had actually invoked executive privilege, because executive privilege has no place in an impeachment hearing. The president cannot invoke executive privilege to cover up his own wrongdoing. That's not the appropriate place for it to exist. So for Jay Sekulow to say, you know, executive privilege has been recognized by the Supreme Court without addressing the context in which executive privilege would be asserted if it is asserted here to block witnesses, is a facetious way of arguing, really not a strong argument.
Howard and Siobhan, let me just quote something that President Trump said. I believe this was in December. And this is a quote here. I would love to have Mike Pompeo, I'd love to have Rick Perry and many other people testify. I don't want them to testify when this is a total fix. Then he goes on to say, I want them to testify in the Senate where they will get a fair trial. Now, Howard, we know that the president can say a lot of things and then say a lot of other things. But should we hold him to that in any way?
Well, he said that knowing that the Senate wouldn't be a fair trial. That's clear. I think he'd already been told and advised and had conversations with various people saying, don't worry, Mr. President, we'll stifle it in the Senate. So he probably felt that he thought it was clever to half-heartedly make the offer in a public statement when he knew it wouldn't happen. Of course, the possibility remains that some of those people will, in fact, be asked to testify.
Right.
It's really interesting. Yeah. What we're discussing here, because I think if this argument continues, it's possible that Chief Justice John Roberts, who in his Supreme Court hat might rule on questions of executive privilege in other contexts, could be asked to make some kind of ruling here. I mean, I doubt that. That's probably his worst nightmare. But again, with the White House saying we can assert executive privilege and Jerry Nadler and others saying you can't, that's a question that's going to be resolved by a majority vote in the Senate, I think. I don't think Roberts is going to want to get in the middle of it, and that right. just, I think, underscores my point, which are these are two universes talking past each other.
And this is Howard Fineman, along with Claire Finkelstein and Siobhan Hughes. We are talking about the first day of the impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate. Began yesterday. It ended early this morning. We're going to talk much more. We got some more clips as well. We got comments as well. So do stay with us. Stay with us. We will be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Siobhan Hughes. She's Capitol Hill reporter for The Wall Street Journal, Howard Fineman, NBC, MSNBC news analyst, and Claire Finkelstein, director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania. Let me play one more clip from yesterday's trial. This is Chief Justice John Roberts, and he's admonishing the House managers and the President's counsel for their manner and their language.
I think it is appropriate at this point for me to admonish both the House managers and the President's counsel in equal terms to remember that they are addressing the world's greatest deliberative body. One reason it has earned that title is because its members avoid speaking in a manner and using language that is not conducive to civil discourse. In the 1905 Swain trial, a senator objected when one of the managers used the word pettifogging, and the presiding officer said the word ought not to have been used. I don't think we need to aspire to that high a standard, but I do think those addressing the Senate should remember where they are.
Siobhan, you were there. Pettifogging, a new word. I think we'll hear a lot today, maybe even going forward. But the Chief Justice stepped in and dressed down the members of both sides for their language.
Yes, and he did not name names, but it was pretty clear that what prompted this was an exchange between Jerry Nadler and some of the White House counsel. Jerry Nadler is the House Judiciary Committee chairman, and when it was his turn to speak regarding a subpoena of John Bolton, he got up and said, if you subpoena John Bolton, we can present you with the entire record of the president's misconduct, or you can choose to be complicit in the cover-up. And then he said directly to the senators' faces, so far I'm sad to say I see a lot of senators voting for a cover-up, which was kind of accusatory. And the White House lawyers lashed out and escalated the conflict and said to the senators, you don't deserve what happened. He accused you of a cover-up. He's making false accusations, that phrase again. And it was a very heated personal moment. And you have to remember, this all took place on the Senate floor, and this is a chamber in which you don't ever dress down another senator by name. It doesn't happen. If it does happen, the words have to be taken down or stricken from the record. And so it was a remarkable moment.
Howard, I was thinking, I think there were 82 senators who voted for aid for Ukraine. This, is, of course, was last year, which was then held up by the president and his people. Most of the members of the U.S. Senate are lawyers, I'm assuming. So here you've got people with an interest in support for Ukraine, but also have a legal background. Is that significant, do you think?
Oh, it's significant, although I'm sure a lot of the Republicans who voted for that, and it looks like most of them did, are telling themselves, well, you know, they're rationalizing by saying, well, they got the money eventually anyway. Of course, that's one of the main Trump clan arguments there, that the money was eventually released, completely ignoring the fact that it was only released after the dirty deal was uncovered. Right. But, yeah, that's probably what they're saying to themselves. I mean, they're lawyers, yes, but they're lawyers in service of their own political survival. And they're looking at, I mean, I was in the gallery for a good bit of this, and I watched the senators individually and as groups. And, you know, some of them were studying the briefs and some of the reading materials, and most of them were listening pretty intently when they weren't nodding off. And but they're listening with an ear for political survival. Not the letter of the law, then they're going to twist the law any way they can see fit. I do think that Jerry Nadler made a mistake doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But Jerry comes from New York, and he comes from, you know, place to precincts where in the Democratic clubs people often wrestled with each other. There's some famous incidents of that on the Upper West Side. So he probably made a mistake there by essentially pointing fingers at senators. That's not done in the Senate, and it was shrewd of the Republican managers, the White House managers, to leap up in their defense.
Claire, I'm holding something that Senator Richard Shelby said over the weekend. This was on ABC's This Week, asked about the president's behavior, saying, well, you know, people do things happen. And I think it's so curious when we're talking about the abuse of power, obstruction of Congress, impeachment, to be so kind of loosey-goosey in a response.
I think the Republicans have really made a deal with the devil here, because they have been on the side for so long of supporting Ukraine against Russia. That's been such a plank of their position and their philosophy. So to be in the position of having to say, oh, well, it doesn't really matter, things happen, and they got the aid eventually, and it's no big deal, is probably anathema to most of them. I think this exposes a real division in the Republican Party between those who are still very strong on our national security priorities and care about our alliance with Ukraine against Russia, and those who were really just wedded to the president, and somehow they have managed, at least in the Senate, to come together enough to decide to stand behind the president on this.
I mean, Siobhan, this is more a thought experiment, but if Hillary Clinton or a Democrat were the president, you know, who would be on which side if it led to impeachment and a trial in the Senate?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine Republicans not pouncing on a Democrat if a Democrat had engaged in some type of similar activity. And to back up for a moment, sure. You know, when the issue involving withholding the money from Ukraine in exchange for investigations first started to surface, Republican senators were in the dark about it. It turned out they had been calling the White House, trying to speak to Trump, begging for the money to be released, saying, why is the money withheld? And there came a moment in very early September when there was a big Appropriations Committee vote on a spending bill, and this issue was hotly debated by Republican senators. And you saw people like Lindsey Graham, who's one of the president's biggest allies, say, I am going to back this amendment to force the money from Ukraine to be released. We cannot stand for this. And in fact, the senators at that time thought it was because they had the votes to force the aid to be released that the White House eventually went ahead and released the money.
But here they are, though, at least publicly in lockstep with the White House. What explains that?
I think Howard is spot on. Trump's base is so supportive of him. They are with him until he dies. The Republican senators know that, and they know it is untenable to remain a Republican senator if they oppose Trump. And they look at what happened to the Arizona Senator Jeff Flake, who took Trump on directly, what happened to Bob Corker. Neither of them is in the Senate anymore.
Howard, I'm looking at a recent Quinnipiac poll. A slight majority of voters, 51-46%, approve of the House of Representatives' vote to impeach President Trump, and going on from there. I mean, public opinion, I mean, clearly is pretty much divided on this issue. How does that play into the politics here?
Well, I think a lot of those same polls show that there's a pretty clear majority, which arithmetically has to include a bunch of Republicans, that witnesses should be called. And I think what the Democrats are doing here politically is in the obverse of what the Republicans were doing to the Democratic process in the House. They're saying here in the Senate, the fix is in. They're hiding something. And they forced all these votes far into the night last night on subpoenaing documents and witnesses to try to prove that point. This isn't a trial. Where are the witnesses? Where are the documents? And that could help them politically, and especially if more things emerge, either in the press or as the result of possible witnesses coming forward on their own or who knows what, over the next few weeks. And if that happens, then the Democrats have laid the predicate for saying, look, this was in fact a cover-up, even if Jerry Nadler shouldn't have pointed fingers at him last night.
Well, there's Lev Parnas and sort of where that's going to take us. Let me go back.
Who knows?
Let me go back to you, Claire, and talking about subpoenas and even the role that Roberts could play if there are subpoenas and if they make their way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
So I think it's important first to note that one of the most important reasons to call witnesses is that it reverses what happened in the House, namely that the Democrats could not get their witnesses in because of the president's obstruction. So let's be clear. He is the second count of impeachment against him is obstruction of Congress. And now it looks as though that very obstruction is what is preventing the Democrats from making their full case. Now, what could happen if the Senate does vote to send out subpoenas, is that the president could then say, I'm using my executive privilege to tell them, to instruct them, those witnesses, not to testify. At that point, it wouldn't just be up to Roberts to say, oh, well, yeah, they have to testify, mm-hmm. because the Senate doesn't really have any way of enforcing that. The sergeant at arms is not a police force. He cannot go in and really physically drag the witnesses in. So what would happen is that the Senate would have to file subpoenas that would then be enforced in a court. They'd have to file an action in a federal district court, and that could wend its way up to the Supreme Court. And what would then happen if the question of whether the president can block witnesses by exerting executive privilege came before the Supreme Court when Chief Justice Roberts is presiding over the impeachment trial? Presumably, he would have to recuse himself, and the Supreme Court would be evenly divided between four liberals and four conservatives, and could be deadlocked.
Wow. Siobhan, let me go back to you. What is going to happen today? It's NPR is going to begin its coverage and HYY at 1 o'clock this afternoon. But yesterday was all about rules and procedures. So what's going to happen today?
So today we start the opening arguments with the House Democrats going first, and then they have as many as 24 hours to make their case over 3 days, followed by Republicans. It's worth noting that there was a deadline this morning to file pretrial motions, and so we were all watching to see whether Republicans were going to offer a motion to dismiss, because at one point Donald Trump had come out and said he wanted to dismiss the case, and Mitch McConnell had really tried to persuade him against that. What we learned this morning is that nobody filed any motions, so Mitch McConnell seems to have won that argument, and we are going to go straight to the substance of the case. Of course, the Democrats did a good job of previewing all of those arguments in the debate over the rules, and so we are likely to see those arguments amplified now for the next few days.
Well, Howard, just shows you how powerful Mitch McConnell is in the Senate.
Well, he's a master. And the way that the rules were written, and this hasn't been much commented on, but he laid an extra step in there in terms of getting to the possibility of witnesses. I'm not versed enough in the arcana of Senate rules to understand it exactly, but I think what the language says is at some point there may be a vote on whether it's permissible to even put in a motion to call a witness. So he added an extra step in there, which I think is probably designed to give senators who need some cover an ability, some Republicans, an ability to explain it both ways. You know, they can vote for one and against the actual or the other. I mean, he's an absolute master of this, and he does it for his own political and even cynical reasons. But, yeah, he's very good at it. I will say this. I don't think he was expecting Adam Schiff to do what he did. Schiff went in there and went straight to the case, and in a very forceful and pretty convincing way, standing in the well a few feet from McConnell. And I've known McConnell for a long time, since I started as a reporter in Louisville, and I was watching McConnell as his eyes widened a little bit as Schiff took what was supposed to be a procedural day and turned it in a substantive way. Basically, Schiff gave an executive summary of the whole argument yesterday.
Claire, let me just toss something else out. I know you want to respond to something Howard just said, but this is the president. This was in October on the White House lawn, and this is a quote from the president. China should start an investigation into the Bidens because of what happened in China is just as bad as what happened in Ukraine. So I would say that President Zelensky, if it were me, I would recommend that they start an investigation into the Bidens. We have a president who tells us in public what he wants to do.
Well, and remember, again, he believes that Article 2 allows him to do anything he wants. So he does not think he is doing anything wrong or committing a crime or even behaving inappropriately when he reaches out to foreign nations and asks them to help him with his reelection campaign. That is really what the impeachment trial is all about, because pushing back on that exaggerated view of executive authority is something that our system, a correction that our system has needed for a long time.
Is our system up to it, though?
I don't know the answer to that. It at the moment looks as though a majority in the Senate is planning to side with that view of executive authority. And it's been a long time building. We saw a steady expansion of executive authority and claims of executive privilege after 9/11. And that's both Democrats and Republicans. We saw it with Obama as well as with President Bush. So this is a moment where sort of our chickens are coming home to roost. And it's an important moment for addressing the idea of a very expansive executive power.
I agree with that. And I appreciate all three of you joining us today in Radio Times. Claire Finkelstein, thanks for coming in. She's director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania. Howard Fineman, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And he's NBC, MSNBC news analyst. And Siobhan Hughes, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
So good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Capitol Hill reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Aronson, Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you so much for joining us.